This is Geek Speak, episode 34 of season 16. I'm Lyle Trox. With me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie.
Always a pleasure.
And this week we have software engineer working in the clouds and a roller derby nerd, Dee Dee Hubbard. Hey, Dee Dee.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Last broadcast, you were with us. Thanks for joining us. And prior to that, you were mostly with us in 2003, 2004, prior to your graduate master's degree program, where you left California and made us suffer.
I had a really good time in New York, though. Thanks for asking.
I know you had a good time. I followed you. It was great.
And now, once again, you rejoin us as the most educated geek in the group.
Oh, by far. Wait, are any of the other geeks like regular, like, do they have degrees?
I have a bachelor's degree, but it's in lit.
And Brian has a degree, I think, in art.
Right. So, back to tech.
With the measure of degrees.
Software engineer working in the clouds. What clouds do you work in?
I work with a group that was acquired last summer by Cisco. So, if you've ever heard of Piston Cloud Computing.
That's the group that was acquired?
Right, crickets. We worked on a product that helped bootstrap and orchestrate the cloud infrastructure, sort of like infrastructure as a service for OpenStack clouds. And since being acquired, we are now re-implementing most of that underneath a lot of Cisco's infrastructure, including the Metapod, MetaCloud team. They keep going back and forth on the name.
You say a lot of technical words that are also kind of like salesy words. What do you mean by those things? First off, what languages are you working in?
I'm working in Python. I mean, if you want me to break it down to what I actually do every day,
yeah,
I automate the crap out of things.
So anything that you could do manually, you stop that and make it automated.
Right. We want to make sure that you can do all of your provisioning, so like deciding what goes on a server and what work needs to be done there, and all of the sort of like getting that to work with multiple machines to make a cluster of machines. We want to make sure that you can do that as quickly and as automated as possible.
So you can like spin up multiple instances to do your workload.
Right.
So that nature. Okay.
And so like the fewer manual processes you have in there, the more likely you are to be able to do this rapidly, iterate on it, do updates, testing, CI, all of the...
Because humans cause problems.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, cool. Thanks. Let's talk about space, shall we? Rocket ships, Miles?
Yeah, SpaceX landed its rocket again.
Yeah, it's done this before.
Yes. Okay. It's now its sixth rocket landing. And the thing is, it's both a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is that they are now able to reduce their costs by 30% for rocket launches.
Because they can reuse the parts.
Because they reuse
the... When we first covered this, we weren't sure what kind of savings they'd actually would get. 30% decrease in its costs is good.
Yes. It's not an order of magnitude type of thing that we were wondering if it would be. But it's still non... I mean, that's a nice chunk.
That's a good thing, yeah. And it's cool to land your spaceship on a barge. I mean, that's just kind of cool.
Yes, and it's the fourth time that they've landed on the ship, on the barge. Mm-hmm. And so that makes 4 out of 5 tries on the barge has been successful.
That's pretty good. I mean, not for man's flight, but for our recovery.
But I mean, they're doing something that had never been done before, and they're doing it now with regularity. And there comes the concern that I have anyway, which is it's just like the moon landings, which did in fact happen. Thank you very much. that after a certain point, people went like, oh, they're going to the moon again.
Right.
We're not really concerned about it. And even though it was still doing really good science, even though it was still pushing boundaries, it lost the public imagination. The bright side about it with SpaceX is that there's a market for it, which there wasn't for moon landings. But it's still something that I wish that we could keep that excitement.
But I don't think that's – I think human nature is kind of repetition produces disinterest. Like, that's kind of how it works.
Oh, is it just like football?
What? What do you mean?
Yes, because when you watch a game of football...
I don't watch football. Go on. Sorry.
The rules change every single time. It's
repetitive, is what you're saying.
What we find interest in is also largely a a product of what we as a society put value on, and how we decide to spend the money on marketing it.
Yeah, but keep in mind, let's take the football analogy versus spaceship analogy. A rocket landing is not, there's nothing empathetic about that compared to a whole bunch of people
fighting. That's true. It's not human.
Yeah.
It's not human in the end result. It's just
what you really need is mecha. You know, you need like human or animalistic giant robots landing. And then we get into...
Oh, wow. If SpaceX could land a rocket into the hand of a giant mecha,
yes.
I think that would attract a whole lot
that
more
would
attention.
Work.
No, you have multiple SpaceXs come down, and then they form a giant robot.
Oh, man. Oh, Voltron.
Oh, beautiful. Nerds. All right, let's talk about something less exciting and fun, but it's still about space. Tell me about Apollo missions and what we've learned more lately about Apollo missions.
Well, I've learned... I think I knew this in the past. My father taught me a lot of sort of extracurricular things about history, and especially African-American history. But a lot of people are going to be tuned into Hidden Figures, which is a new film coming out probably I think the release date is in January, with a book that's coming out in the next month or so.
Is it a documentary?
No, it's a biopic.
Okay.
So anybody who has sort of watched a lot of the behind-the-scenes type space movies like, I've lost it. The Martian was one, right? And like...
Apollo 13.
Apollo 13 was like, there was a lot more about the astronauts. I guess it wasn't, the problem that I'm thinking is it wasn't really a space movie. It was that movie with, about Alan Turing. It also went into a little bit about the
Imitation Game.
Right.
The Imitation Game, yeah.
It went into a little bit about the people trying to build the engine to break the Enigma.
Right.
And how that was like a real big people problem as well as a machine problem. Well, this is going into the story of, they have these three black women who worked with NASA as computers. They were...
Back before we had the modern definition of computer, the person who crunched numbers was a computer.
Computers used to be people. Mm-hmm. It's made of people.
Soylent Green. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, so they were doing the calculations of the trajectories in and out of orbit and...
the rocket science is what you're saying.
They were doing the literal rocket science.
All right. And so this movie is called Hidden Figures, I'm assuming because we weren't... as a public, very aware of this. Your father might have taught you this story, but in general layman terms, these women were not part of the story of going to the moon.
No, and the trailer looks really awesome because they address it directly in the trailer. There's a point where you see some of the very pretty boy astronauts walking towards their mission, and they're passing by the people that are going to help them get there. And one of the women comments on how cute he is, and the other one's like, I don't have to discriminate in my likes, because really the reason why they might not know astronauts might not know about them because I mean they're really behind the scenes, they're the nerds in the background,
right.
But even more so, there are also these black women who are generally sort of
mistaken for janitors,
the janitorial staff or the maid. And they're right up in the front next to all the other engineers and
And this, of course, is you can find these pictures of the astronauts walking across the field and these people there and no one knows what they were doing.
The official trailer just came out.
That's really cool. All right. So Hidden Figures comes out.
January 13th, 2017.
All right. Cool. Do you remember your dad talking about these women?
He just made me study them.
What a good father.
There were a lot of books.
Is your father a historian?
He loves history.
Yeah. All right. So Google was doing fiber everywhere, and every time I heard them take another city online, I was like, I want some of that fiber, but they're not bringing that to my town of Ben Lomond or Santa Cruz in general.
Right. Or even San Jose. They were running some problems there.
Or in Los Gatos.
I have fiber.
Where are you? Where do you have fiber?
Emeryville.
Why does Emeryville have fiber?
Well, it's not Google fiber.
Is it a SonicNet?
WebPass.
Okay.
Who's that? Who
good,
knows?
Good question.
They give me that bandwidth. I don't care who they are.
I get 200 them. Up and down, and it really turns out to be 300 up and down, and
oh
I'm
my
happy.
Gosh. How much does it cost? Wait, don't even tell me. I think I'll be too depressed. Okay, how much is it?
65.
Oh, that's better and cheaper. But you do have to live in Emeryville.
At any rate. Google Fiber, however, is 1 gigabit per second up and down, symmetrical.
Yeah, if you could get that.
And at a competitive rate, so much less than what we pay. Mm-hmm. But their biggest problem, biggest hurdle, is when they go to those towns to wire it up, they have to fight a whole lot of legal battles for tearing up the streets to put in, to lay down the fiber, to get rights to go on the poles. Because the incumbents that are in this space, the Comcast, the Charters, the AT&Ts, are like, we don't want you to use this.
They'll throw it on any block they can.
Right. So Google is trying to sidestep that, or at least it looks like it, and they're looking at beaming high-speed wireless internet. So instead of using that last mile as trying to get onto the poles to each and every house, you just have them set up a dish and do line of sight and –
Are they starting that program somewhere that would help me?
I am sorry, but at your home, line of sight is not an option.
I live in Redwood Forest, as does Miles. Miles, you live next to like one of the famous Redwood Forests.
Yes. When you're watching documentaries and they talk about the great Redwood Forest, it's like, yeah, that's
across the street. Yeah. Miles lives in Felton, California, very close to Henry Cowell, which is a famous reserve of redwood, old-growth redwood trees. And if you're ever in Santa Cruz, go to Felton and go to Henry Cowell and walk through the one-mile walk. It's flat and amazingly cool. Even when it's raining, it's cool. But anyway, you're right. Not very good for point-to-point Wi-Fi, unless you like want to put it on top of a redwood tree. Where are they launching these things? Where are they doing this?
Well, so far they just announced it, and they're looking like they're going to pivot. Yeah. So they haven't announced towns yet. This is just like when they first announced fiber, they hadn't really announced towns yet. They were.
I'm wondering like how broad. Like I know it's kind of point to point. Like you aim something at them, and they aim something at you. But I wonder how many service points you can access that way. Can you put it on top of a building and hit like a block one antenna?
It depends upon how many fiber connections you have going to that central access point to be able to route off of, and how fast your switching is.
I mean, it's comparable to next generation, you know, the most current generation of cell services, right? It's just a different type of band.
Mm-hmm.
And probably a non-licensed band.
You know, right. And in the lab, some researchers have been able to get 1 terabit per second over 100 meters in the lab.
Yeah, that's not useful because that's in the lab. 1 terabyte per second?
1 terabit per second, yeah.
That's pretty good.
That even if it's in the lab, like that's a nice threshold to go off.
Yeah, is that 4 meters or is that like...
No, that's 100 meters.
That's a big lab.
Yeah. Well, you're working with, you know, radio waves or light, so...
100 meters isn't that long. But anyway.
Gets to my back sheds.
That's what you need, is a terabyte to the back shed. You haven't even run power to the back shed. It's useless for you.
I don't want to know what you keep in your shed.
He keeps old computers that don't work and an Arduino that one day will.
No. That's my parents' garage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. That's cool that they're looking at wireless. I think that it does make a lot of sense to go wireless, though I got to say, I do have Cat 5 in part of my home, and when I plug into that, I feel the power. Even though I have pitiful bandwidth up to the net, it's at least extremely reliable, even when my microwave's turned on.
Well, I'm frustrated with network speed.
Yeah.
Like, I'm frustrated with the fact that there aren't 10 gigi connections on motherboards and laptops and the like. Because and when I say 10 gigi, I mean 10 gigabit Ethernet. Because 10 gigabit...
Can Cat 5 or Cat 5e or Cat 5 blah, blah,
Cat 5e and Cat 6.
Support 10 gig?
Yes. Cat 5e can, although not necessarily over the entire 100 meter distance.
It's your favorite number.
Yes. But Cat 6 can over the full distance, and Cat 6a is, fully certified for that. That's what you want to use.
Just better shielding and thicker copper or something like that. So you can do 10 gigabit Ethernet. Why don't I have this running in my home? I need that. I don't know why I need that, but I need that.
Well, that's the thing, though, is the adapters are ridiculously expensive. And when I say that, yes, they're going down in price. But right now, gigabit Ethernet on a laptop or on a motherboard or on a, you know, single board computer nowadays, mm-hmm. it's just it's an afterthought.
Right.
Like a $50 single board computer can you'll find them with
gigabit
Ethernet. But 10 gig Ethernet, suddenly you're jumping up into the $250, $300 range just for
the throughput of 10 gig. Can an average hard drive really do that?
That's the thing. If you have an SSD of my generation of laptop, so I have a 2012, and that has SATA 3. So that maxes out to 500 megabytes per second, slightly above, but that's about it. So
you just said the gigabit's fine.
Gigabit, not gigabyte.
Oh, right.
So divide that by 8, you end up with 125 megs a second, which is noticeably slower than 500 megs a second.
Yes.
And so then you get into the newer MacBook Pros and things like that. They're using the M2 connector or PCIe bus. And then you start getting into the 1.5, 1.7, now getting into, with like Samsung products, the mm-hmm. 2.5
that's some serious
gigabits
throughput.
Per second.
Yeah.
And so you look at that and it's like, oh, well, divide that by 8. Now you're in the
above 1 gig.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well above.
Yeah. That's okay. I can see the reason for it. And also, and there's new drives coming out all the time too. So do you think that why we had this glut in the faster 10 gig? Why isn't it in every laptop? I mean, it's not like the electronics is that much more expensive from the manufacturing perspective.
Well, I don't know, because apparently they are having some trouble with that. Otherwise, you'd think they would show up. But maybe for a while people thought like, oh, we won't need it. We didn't put the investment into it.
I hadn't really thought much about it. I really thought, yeah, 1 gig is fine. There's no big deal there. Right. But it's interesting.
There was a point where we were about as fast on the network as our hard drives could go, the spinning Rust. And so you could put a NAS device out there, and it was just like you had a hard drive over the network. And nowadays, it's like there is a noticeable speed differential between them, and it's getting wider and wider.
Speaking of NASs, Didi, you recently
network attached storage.
Nicely done, sir. you recently contacted me and said, "Hey, what do you recommend?" Was it like a thread of geek friends of yours that were kind of all chiming in? You finally hooked up a NAS. You set something up. What'd you do?
Yeah, I went a little bit against some of the people that I tapped into, actually.
Well, I think that's the part of research, right? I mean, there was four different suggestions that I heard, so obviously couldn't take them all.
I was really heavily leaning towards Synology to start mm-hmm. with, because I've heard really great things.
Because you listen to Hypercritical?
Because I listen to Hypercritical, and I love John Siracusa.
You know, the thing is, he got that because he was given the Synology because of the podcast, and they all got it, and they liked him.
Right, but he liked it. He doesn't like anything.
He doesn't like anything, that's true.
And so I was leaning that way, but then as I did more research on it, and in that thread, one of my friends suggested looking at QNAP.
And QNAP?
QNAP. It's
QNAP.
QNAP?
QNAP. Okay. That one came up, and they were trying to compete, I guess, head-to-head with some of the more generic brands mm-hmm. that you can get out there, like Netgear is a big player and all these other people.
For years, we talked a lot about Netgear's ReadyNAS. It used to be a separate company, and it was bought by Netgear, and a geek of the show. Actually, you were on the show with Drew, right?
Yeah.
And Drew, I think, still works for ReadyNAS. So I have a couple ReadyNAS devices, Netgear/ReadyNAS devices, that I still use. I like them a lot. At the same time, I've been aware that they're kind of aged out.
Yeah.
And then for a while, I think I got Drobos for a while. And then I recently got in touch with someone that
Drobos are not your typical NAS.
Well, so the newer Drobo, the one I've got sitting in my house that I haven't actually put the drives in, which is actually a review unit, which I wish I'd gotten to you so you could have reviewed it. but I need to buy some drives for it. That is a network attached storage device. And it does show up as an external, it shows up as a NAS, but it also has management software. That's kind of what you're talking about, whether you have to have management software.
Drobos are kind of like adding a really large extended external hard drive.
Right.
Most of them. Versus like standing on the network by itself, freestanding network detached storage with operating system and all that.
Yeah, the Drobo in that I've got is a network attached storage device, but I haven't hooked it up to see if it's like multiple shares or not. So what you're saying is it looks like they try to do as much as possible to make it look like one hard drive?
Well, you have that option or you can split up the volumes, but
it's not the same.
That's sort of like
we can look at one of our older shows to find out all about the Drobo we reviewed. QNAP, one of the things I liked about, just to put a little plug, was they have a slot for a PCIe slot, so you can put a 10 gigy adapter into it.
You just won't let this go, will you?
Yeah.
No,
that's awesome. That's awesome.
It ties in.
Okay, so go on. But
that was the thing, is that when I was starting to compare them with Synology, most in particular, QNAP was trying to become more competitive, so they iterated a little bit faster, I guess you'd say, than Synology. So their hardware is more advanced, or they might be around the same, but you know, they keep leapfrogging each other, but they keep trying different things. So like their operating system, it doesn't seem as polished as the demo thing you can try with Synology. But the thing that I wound up getting, it has like a dedicated chip for encryption.
Which is QNAP sells its own hardware, or is it just an operating system?
It sells its own hardware.
So you bought one of their units.
Yeah, I bought a QNAP 453A. The A is for that AES, because it has like an extra chip to do AES encryption back and forth, so that I can.
And
have
AES encryption is used for what?
When you cycle the NAS on and off, the data is encrypted.
On the drives?
Unless I go in and I add in my key and I decrypt it. So, like, if something were to happen and...
Your data is private.
My data is private as long as someone turns it off and on again.
No problem. So if you're running out of the house, you got to turn off the breaker.
Yeah.
So, but for that device, the reason why it's important to have hardware AES encryption decryption is that the entire drive has to be read and written through encryption.
Yeah,
and
just
so you
makes
want
it
that
faster.
Hardware based. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's beyond what's available in like a modern processor. Modern processors have AES.
Well, see, that's one of the things about QNAP is that they use like beefier CPUs, mm-hmm. and they give you more memory for your buck. Synology, they're using like Celerons and some like ARM stuff, and so they're like sort of like a little bit lower end on power and juice and everything, but you know, they make up for it with a really like Apple-like simple interface and everything.
And the QNAP is not as simple?
It's quirky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's also the distinction of whether or not, because NAS, the concept of a NAS is not complex. You have a box, you have an operating system, you have a bunch of drives, and you grab data from it and you pull it from it. And there may be some differences, like does it support NFS versus SMB, you know, Windows networking versus Unix networking.
And that's all the software layer.
Right.
And most of these are running a Linux derivative in the core of it, right?
Unless you're FreeNAS, actually, that distribution is BSD-based, FreeBSD-based. But that's the question is, if you build your own, which if you're inclined to do that, I highly recommend it because you're going to learn how to manage that.
Half of my friends said I should just
build your own.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Run your own
But it's funny, I looked at that in terms of components, and you're not saving money. One of the things about Synology and QNAP is they have figured it out for you, and they've used these components that have been optimized to say, like, this is as good as it's going to get for this price point. And saving you that time can be worth it. Otherwise, when you're buying it, it's going to be like some parts going to be so much faster than the others that you're not going to get any advantage from it. And so you're always going to be limited by the lowest common denominator. But you have a lot more flexibility.
Yeah.
So you have a question to say like, hey, I want to do deduplication. Let me put 64 gigs of RAM in here.
This is similar to building your own network router, right? Where you can build a machine, put multiple NICs in it, run software, do all that, or you can buy an off-the-shelf unit that probably will cost less and do everything you need to do. So all these devices are a small shell that holds hard drives and a small board and, of course, network-attached storage and a fan. Are these things fanned?
It does have a fan.
And is it running loud? I mean,
it's actually really quiet.
Oh, that's nice.
And you can have the blinking lights go all the way off if you really want. So it can be just this little black box in the corner.
The ReadyNAS I have replaced the fan because it was loud. And I replaced the fan with a fan that ran at 24 volts, even though its voltage supply is 12. So it runs real slow and it's quieter and all that, just to get rid of that fan noise. But it's still too loud to be like in the same room. But of course, it's network storage. So who cares? Put it in a closet somewhere. Assuming there's airflow then.
Yeah, I mean, so let's say the airflow is going to be an issue. Yeah.
The fan is probably too loud if you're John Siracusa, though.
That's true. we brought up John Syracuse twice now. You're wearing a Hypercritical t-shirt, which is his former podcast. The podcast I've been listening to regularly that he's on now is called ATP, or Accidental Tech Podcast. The podcast is with Marco Arment, and we've mentioned him because of his great iOS
podcast app.
Podcasting app, an app that you subscribe to podcasts with. Anyway, shall we move on? Let's do that.
Oh, did I mention that the QNAP that I got can also work as a karaoke machine, and that was what put me over the top?
Oh, tell me more about this. Does it have sound card?
It has, in the back, you can plug in two microphones, and they have...
What kind of microphones?
Quarter inch.
No, okay.
So, yeah, you just plug in some quarter inch into the back, and they have this beta software you download, and you just load up a bunch of karaoke songs, and boom.
That is very cool. Is the software part of the operating system already?
They have a whole series of apps that you can sort of download.
Have you done it already?
I haven't done the karaoke yet. I'm still getting all of my music into it.
How are you doing that?
I'm ripping it all into Apple Lossless, which Miles would disagree with me and say I should use FLAC.
Because he's an open source pedant.
But
Actually, Apple Lossless is open source as well.
Yeah. Which is enables me to use the software XLD, which is probably a year old at least right now. But I would not recommend that if you're going to do any sort of amount of ripping that you care about, like if you needed to, say, rip a CD that is like scratched up or maybe will disappear in a few days, like you might give it to somebody. I would say that you don't want to use iTunes at all for this, because iTunes will just sometimes skip songs.
So
completely.
Okay, first off,
silently.
What hardware are you using to rip these things?
At first I was just using the drive that came in the Mac Pro.
The optical
drive in the Mac Pro. But I recently also purchased like a little Blu-ray super drive like thing that gets
better performance.
Yeah, it's powered off of USB 3 mm-hmm. and everything.
Is it a burner too?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so your job for today's at the end of the show is to take all the things you're talking about and add links for Chandler if he can't find these things, the SuperDrive especially.
Yeah, it's funny talking
so
about that.
So we can have it on the show page.
This harkens back to way back in the day when I was first ripping my CD collection, because it took forever.
Yeah.
And there was a period in time where you got the fastest CD-ROM reader that you could, so that you could read the CDs faster, and there were software outfits that would rip the CDs faster, because mm-hmm. the basic ones would just have it play CD audio
real time.
Yeah, which was 150 kilobits a second or kilobytes a second, and then you had ones that were like ripping at 14 times speed as long as you had a fast enough drive.
Right.
And
but the drives nowadays are pretty fast, even if you can find a machine that has one.
Right,
in there.
But as Didi was pointing out, you don't want to do this with iTunes, because iTunes ripping speed does not match the drives.
Why?
There's probably a gazillion reasons why, but if you want to rip something with accuracy, one, you're going to want to turn on the error checking, mm-hmm. so that if it goes over a sector, it will like check to see.
It's a double read. Make sure you're
right.
doing the same.
Yeah. There's like little bits on the CD that sort of just like with like error correcting memory sort of help you out and guide you along. And you want the CD, the optical drive, to pick those up. One, which adds time.
And that's why you got the software XLD, which does that.
It does that, but it also compares it against an online database called AccurateRip, which is also very helpful.
In the sense that it already has a copy of the same music you're ripping?
So it has like, a signature of it.
Right, yeah. So everybody who's ripped that with software which uses AccurateRip also compares against that, and it's sort of kind of like BitTorrent is the thing that like many people feed you data, and it makes everything faster and better. It's a little bit of crowdsourcing like that,
cool.
AccurateRip. So,
you're ripping all your... That's one of the reasons why you got your NAS, so that you could get rid of your CD collection and just have a hard drive that has all your music on it. And I'm assuming this NAS, the software, the QNAP, also has the ability for you to stream to your phone anywhere you are, so you can like be remote from your house and all that, and use your amazing bandwidth.
Right, so there's...
Doesn't Didi's life seem amazingly cool, Miles? She has time to do that.
Do you want
to remember before we had children?
I mean, if you want to come visit me in Emeryville, there's also like a pool and a jacuzzi, and it's like...
I got a pool. I had to make it, but
yeah, we have trees.
to block our network access. Damn it! We're losing here.
So this raises the question. Where do we put all of these files? Rip all these CDs and if people are inclined.
Wait, before we go on to that, I do want to do that. But the XLD ripping software helps you out with that. But you said that you haven't done your party of singing with your new device because you haven't put all your music on it yet. But you have to get special tracks to do karaoke because you have to get tracks without the audio, without the main vocal on it.
Partially. I mean,
yeah, not necessarily. There are things you can do.
There are some software that lets you sort of back out the vocals of music that you already own, and then there's many lyrics servers out there which would let you try to just throw them, either the lyrics, throw them up there, or add timing to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the stuff I've seen, I've been able to do with Audacity with reasonably good results.
Yeah, you can.
So you take whatever's on the left channel and take whatever's on the right channel, whatever they have in common. That's going to be what's in the center, and you just cancel that out, and you end up taking out a lot of the vocals. It's not perfect. But
yeah. I built a hardware device for that for Ben for his car, like we talked about before, doing exactly that via hardware. And the problem with it is some songs just don't have the lead vocals in the center track, or you completely lose the guitar or something that's actually kind of important to the song sound. But I'm assuming that if you had large databases of the knowledge of the lyrics, you could actually remove them digitally as well. And I haven't seen that software. I was just curious if that existed. But maybe not. Maybe it does.
Totally
let us know. So what are you stuffing? What do you stuff your device with, your QNAP device with? Because you had to buy a drive separately.
I bought, what did I buy? I think there were a bunch of Hitachi drives.
Spinning Rust?
Yeah.
Didn't fork out the giant dough for SSDs?
I mean, I bought 4 3-gigabyte drives.
How about terabyte?
But see, that's
though. Sorry, 4 terabyte drives.
Yeah, that would be expensive in SSDs.
Individual good hard drives. Let's say we round it off because it can be like 150 megabytes.
Let's round off some numbers. Okay.
Megabytes a second. So let's just say 100 megabytes a second just on average. And then you have 5 drives. And let's be charitable and say they're able to all work perfectly in tandem and you get 500 megabytes per second. So even with
non-redundancy here that you're talking about.
No, with the RAID 5. Slicing? No, okay, with the RAID 5. Even with that, even if all the drives were working together almost perfectly, or even if you take away one, just say like 4 drives, it's equivalent to having 4 drives working perfectly, so 400 megabytes a second, you're still more than double the speed of gigabit Ethernet.
Yeah. Okay. I got it. I know. So are you going to put, the NIC in your device? Did you get a device that had the ability to get a 10 gig NIC?
I think. Hold on a
NIC stands for...
Network interface card.
Thanks. I lost it. I seriously couldn't remember. I probably could have figured it out. But Miles, you have a story about another type of hard drive, and I was kind of leaning into that one. So tell us about the other type, the solid-state type.
Well, we talked about how Samsung was releasing a 16-terabyte drive, and how, or 15 or 16, something like that, where it was now dwarfing what you can get with spinning Rust, with the standard hard drive.
The price.
And you're starting to see the switch over. Well, Seagate has announced, hasn't been released yet, it'll be released in 2017, but they've announced a 60-terabyte SSD.
So every once in a while, Miles, I'm hanging out in my house and I'm reading the Slack channel that we use to organize GeekSpeak, you know, when you post something. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I just look at it and go, cool, that'd be fun to talk about. This time I went, oh, Maggie, Seagate just released a 60-terabyte drive, or is about to release a 60-terabyte drive. And she's like, I said, no, it's solid state. And she looked at me and she's like, okay. She understands exactly what I said, but it wasn't like appropriate for like preparing dinner. I was like so excited about it. When are they doing this and how did they do it? How did they get up to that volume? And that's some serious...
Well, first off, most solid state devices are either the M2 formatting, which is a flat... wafer looks kind of the same format as you would have a piece of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
More commonly, especially for laptops, you would have a 2.5-inch drive or a 1.8-inch drive, and those are what SSDs mostly come in.
Right, because that's the form factor that you need for your laptops, so that's the form factor that they're making.
Yeah. Right. If you go to desktops, you go into a 3.5-inch drive, and those are the traditional size for hard drives. We can talk about 5.25, but that was too long ago. Yeah.
The drives you got were 3.5, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So take what you can put into a very thin, 2.5-inch drive, and a 3.5-inch drive is noticeably larger than that. So you're able to stuff a lot more into that enclosure.
So they didn't actually increase the density. They're just offering a form factor that's big.
Well, no, they're still pushing the density. But they're also packing it into the amount that would be suitable for a data center,
right?
Because they're using 3.5-inch format rather than for laptops, which mm-hmm. are space constrained.
See, I don't know if I'd want to spend my, you know, my down payment for a house on a hard drive, because that's what this is going to be, right? This is going to be a professional level cost.
Back in the 70s, a 1 megabyte or a 5 megabyte hard drive from IBM cost millions and had to be loaded onto a cargo plane. So this is just, you know, showing where things are going. And it also is highly unlikely, in my opinion, with how things have been going with spinning Rust, that standard platter hard drives are going to match that anytime soon. I mean, they just made the leap to get to 8 or 10.
Right. Yeah, okay. All right. Thanks for the story about solid-state drives that we can't buy. I appreciate that. That's really wonderful. How much storage did you actually end up having on your new system?
Well, I went with RAID 6, so it's about 4.8 terabytes.
Okay. Miles, RAID 6?
What is RAID 6?
Yeah.
RAID 6 is where you have two drives, two extra drives. So a minimum of
four
drives, right? Although typically you want to have more than that. I should start with RAID 5, just so it's a little bit easier.
RAID 5 is the confusing one in my mind.
RAID 6 is more confusing than RAID 5.
Ooh, let's start with RAID 1.
Okay, we'll start with RAID 0.
Okay,
RAID 0.
You're listening to Geek Speak here. I'm Lyle, and we're talking to Didi and Miles. If you want to learn how to support the show, we'd love it if you visited geekspeak.org/support. Every episode that we do, we put up a show notes, and Chandler's sitting in the room with us quietly, making sure that what we say gets put up with links and all that. And relatively soon, I'll be putting all those into our actual feed so that most of your podcast catchers actually can see all those links. So, maybe this episode even. Check it out. Maybe it's updates happened.
So, Didi, you want to like switch off on these?
It's
like,
yeah. Miles starts with RAID 0.
We'll interleave.
Oh, gosh.
that was bad.
I didn't know there was going to be a quiz.
Okay, so RAID 0. You start off with two drives. And I have this on my laptop. So I got 512 gigabyte drives and put two of them in, took the CD-ROM, DVD-ROM drive out and put another drive in. So I have 1 gigabyte. One terabyte of storage in my laptop. And so half of the read comes from one drive, and the other half of the read comes from the other, and half the write goes to one drive, and half the write goes to the other.
That's called striping, right?
Yes.
And that's faster.
It is.
For reading.
And for writing, because half the write goes to one drive, and half the write goes to the other.
But it's not redundant. If one of those drives dies, you lose all
your data.
Absolutely
not redundant. Anything happens to one drive, the whole thing's gone. So you need backups.
So it's double the bad.
But it's useful for just raw speed.
And you do a lot of database work. So
I wanted extra speed, especially with a laptop that is now 4 years old.
This is the laptop that you changed the screen on, right?
Yes.
Okay.
did you fix the thing where it says the model?
No. No. Hey, I thought we were only going to bring this up next February. So
I wasn't there.
Okay, so RAID 1, Didi.
RAID 1 is the safer of the two between RAID 0 and RAID 1, RAID 1. RAID 1, you have two drives, and they're mirrored. So if one goes bad, you still have the other one. So everything is copied onto both drives.
So when you write something, you have to write to both drives.
So it's slower to write.
But the read, you could technically read from either, or do you have to read from both and compare?
Or depending upon the bus, it's about the same speed as a single drive for writes, but double the speed for reads. Because it can read half the information from one drive and read half.
It depends on how it's being done, what you're saying. If the operating system's doing it, then it could take a little bit slower. But if there's a hardware card in there that's handling it.
On the contrary, I was thinking operating system, the software RAIDs are really good now.
Okay. But no, neither of you are running, I mean, we're not running ones.
I am not, no.
So what's two? Or is two not interesting? We'll just skip to five.
Two, three, and four are historical slots. Artifacts.
Okay, holes. All right, so get to five.
They were useful. I mean, just people working through. RAID 5 is if you have.
Let me do this one. Can I do this one?
Okay, yeah, go all for right. it.
So RAID 5, you start with, let's say, four disks, and now you have the storage of four disks, and then you add a fifth disk, and that fifth disk is actually just the difference of the other drives. So effectively, every time you add an...
Also known as?
What?
Parity.
Parity, right. So, but it's a little more complicated than that any of those drives actually offer parity of another two. So any drive can be lost at any time, and you're fine. You lose more than one drive, you've got a problem. But your size is actually... all your drives added together minus one drive, and that's effectively what a RAID 5 is.
Well, it's dangerous if you lose a drive and you also have an error on another drive.
Right. Losing two drives would be critical, like failure. Having an error on one can't be corrected by, yeah. So,
yeah.
But the thing that's nice is it is relatively fast to read from, correct? Because it's kind of like a stripe?
It doesn't really have performance speeds. RAID 5 is not as fast as RAID 1. Or it depends. If you add a lot of drives, it can get faster. But then again, you're adding a whole lot of drives.
Yeah.
Just for the basic setup of RAID 5, a minimum of three disks, it's going to be the speed, the capacity of two drives and the speed of less than two drives.
Right. I use RAID for mine as I use a RAID 5 configuration. Okay, so RAID 6.
RAID 6 is adding another drive. Huh? I thought it was my turn.
Oh, no.
TD did it with symbols.
No. I was being supportive.
Oh, okay. RAID 6 is you're adding another drive solely for parity. But that parity is still mixed in with all the other drives. So
it's
if
like
you
a
have
safe RAID 5?
A safer RAID 5, yeah. So if you have a minimum of four drives instead of a minimum of three... you have an N minus two, two.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You have two parity drives.
Right. So if any one drive pops out, then you still could have a second drive die before you lose information.
Right. When I said diff, it's a diff drive, and you then said, no, it's a parity drive. Why do you call it a parity drive? They both do, it's effectively the same thing, yes?
The thing is, if you have two drives, I could see saying a diff. But yeah. What is a diff with four drives?
I see. You're looking at the stripe across and then doing a parity of the stripe.
Yeah, you're computing some value based upon the data present on the other drives.
Right, okay, cool.
That was,
wow, that was a fun
gobbledygook.
That was a fun little extra
bonus
thing.
But there's also
things.
RAID 0 plus 1 and RAID 10.
Yeah.
Let's do that another day.
Okay.
No, go ahead. Tell us.
RAID 0 plus 1 is you take minimum of four drives, and you take two drives that are done as RAID 1, and then you stripe them.
Okay.
So that those two RAIDs, think of you have two drives as a RAID.
Yeah, sure.
So think of that as a single unit. Then you
Which
have
one
two
is that one called?
That's a 0 plus 1.
0 plus 1, okay. It's basically a 0 and a 1.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. No, I had that backwards. If you had two that are striped and then you mirror them, that's 0 plus 1.
Yeah. So they want to be 1 plus 0.
So 1 plus 0 is you have two sets of mirror drives that are striped between each other.
You're just trying to have your cake and eat it too.
No. Yeah, RAID 0 plus 1 and RAID 1 plus 0 are very similar. What's called RAID 10, just to make it simpler
that's
for
That's what
people.
They're called? Is RAID 10?
They call it RAID 10, even though it's RAID 1 plus 0.
Oh, so RAID 1 plus 0 and RAID 10 are the same thing.
Yes.
Thank you. Can we move on now?
Well, there's RAID 50.
Okay, shut up.
RAID 50 is two RAID 5s striped together as a RAID 0.
Oh, that makes sense. So is there a RAID 60?
I would imagine so.
I thought I was being clever there. Didi, let's talk a little bit about learning to code.
Oh, okay.
I feel like we already have a very full show, so we could actually stop today. We could do that next week. You want to drive down here again next week?
By the way, yes, there's a RAID 60.
Of course there is. We just make up numbers by adding the other two together.
I believe you just asked me if I want to wake up again at 6 a.m. again.
Is that what you had to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's like having kids.
You know when my alarm normally goes off?
9.
Well, it's close.
What?
8.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It used to be 8:30.
So you had to wake up at 6 so you could work from the Cisco office that's closer to the Netflix office.
Yeah.
So you could hop over after the show.
Yeah.
Or after the work thing.
So I could physically be in the studio.
I am working on a pattern of being able to incorporate you more via remote. I think we will be doing that in the future because there's so many great people we know remote, like Alex, for example, our security expert.
Well, we have a history of it. I was the New York correspondent for
quite a while. So we just need to get good hardware in everybody's houses, and I'll make that work. Miles,
what do you think? And then I need to put up acoustic foam and wire up my shred for power. and then I actually have a Ben Lomond, or I mean a SLV, you know, recording.
You can be Felton. I'll be in Ben Lomond. I mean, if we do this, we might just stop recording at Netflix. We might just do it at our homes. And then Chandler will be like, what? But I'm in Los Gatos still, everybody. Come back.
Then we need a big screen TV so that we can see each other with a webcam. And it's, I guess a laptop is sufficient. But it has to be a separate screen, though, so that way you can, anyway.
Yeah. D? Code. Coding.
You want to go into it?
Well, you're here, and you want to talk about it, and I'd like to talk about it because you're here.
I was reading an article about this free, as in beer, coding school, 42. It started off in France, and now they have one in Fremont, so right here in the valley.
It's called 42.
42. And as in the answer to life, the liberty,
the universe, and everything.
I'm sorry, I do have to stop you. You said as an aside, free as in beer.
Yes.
And that will go way over some people's heads. So just a short...
You can go listen to our Stallman episode of GeekSpeak if you want to learn more details about this. But yes, please tell us what you mean free as in beer.
Well, I can give you a beer and that would be free. Just like going to the school is free as in you can spend no money on it.
Okay.
Not necessarily that you can take the curriculum and freely use it everywhere.
Like open source free software, right, where it's free as in liberty.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a function of the English language free being an ambiguous word.
Right.
So you have to qualify it with free as in beer.
Yes.
As opposed to free as in speech.
Do you drink beer?
No.
I didn't think so. Go on.
So 42 in the U.S. has just opened in the last month or so. They also have optional free dorms and free laundry.
Wait, how did they pay for these things that are free?
French billionaire.
French. See? Socialism. That's how it works. Kill the wealthy, and then you can take care of people.
Xavier Niel, the billionaire founder of Free, France's second largest ISP. He started this...
next to Orange, by the way. Orange is the big one.
Oh, okay. Next to Orange.
Miles has the Orange microphone, so he's representing. Go on. So he invested tons of money on Free,
or compliments,
the school.
Yes. So it started up in France. And I guess it did well enough there that they decided that they would bring it over here. And why not right next to the valley, where hopefully people who graduate from this program will eventually get jobs and, you know, propagate the word of 42 or whatever. But the main thing about the 42 that's interesting, besides the fact that it's free, is that there are really no teachers involved. So... the students,
because you can't pay them anyway.
Well, I mean, that probably helps keep the bottom line low. There's a help desk of people that are like supposed to help guide you somewhat and like nudge you in directions, but really, they have these signs around that say, if you have a problem, Google it, and if you still have a problem, then ask your neighbor.
So, what is it besides a space to go hang out in?
Well, they have. I mean, there is a curriculum that they want you to go through.
Okay, so there is a curriculum, but it's self-guided curriculum, and there's a space to physically be in to be reminded you can Google things.
Right. So, like, there's an intensive course they call the piscine, which is pool in French, so that they can like toss you into the deep end of the pool, which you either sink or you swim. So if you swim, you will survive this intensive opening course, and then be invited back for more teachings over the next year to 3 years.
So you have a history of highly structured education at, where were you, Brown before University UCSC? Were you?
I don't know who you're talking about.
No?
No, it was Harvey Mudd.
Harvey Mudd, sorry. I knew it was one of those. Anyway, Harvey, you were at Harvey Mudd.
You're like Brown because of Mudd?
I don't know. I don't know.
There's actually a lot of grass.
You know what it is? I don't know where Mudd is, and I don't know where Brown is. And so... like, to me, they're just ambiguous, high prestige colleges that I don't know where they are. Where is Harvey Mudd?
Harvey Mudd is in Claremont, California, which is sort of not too far from, nestled between Pasadena and Riverside.
Yeah, I know where Claremont is. Okay. And what about Brown? Do you know where it is?
It's on the East Coast.
See, I thought Mudd was on the East Coast too. Anyway, I'm a complete idiot. So you... You have highly educated, highly structured education. Then you went to your multiple degrees at UCSC, and then you went and did your graduate work on the East Coast at Tisch School at
ITP.
ITP School. Tisch at what college?
Tisch School of the Arts at NYU.
NYU. Okay. Yeah. So, but very structured curriculums, right?
Yeah. Well, ITP, not so much. Digital arts program. You know how those go.
Yeah, I do. I ran one of those for years. So, in those situations, don't you think your class and having teachers and stuff was useful to your education? Did it get in your way? I mean, what do you think of this whole non-structured education?
Well, in a free-for-all like this, when especially working with your peers, you could find pathways that work for you as an individual. But when you hit brick walls and whatnot, like, it's really nice sometimes to have somebody be able to tell you that you may have found a solution to your problem to get over that brick wall, but you're going to hit a different brick wall on the other side because you chose poorly.
Absolutely, yeah.
There are things that you can do in programming that will slam you up against some really nasty walls. From my education and sort of formally in computer science, there are a lot of algorithmic things that you learn or that you sort of put into your, like, an integral part of you. So it's like in the back of your mind somewhere, even if you aren't actively programming it into what you're actually doing. But when you hit something, you're like, why did this get exponentially slower?
Oh, right, right. Those algorithms are actually helping you guide in. And also when you start to tackle a problem, you go, wait a second. What will emerge if I solve it this way versus this other way? And those are those core algorithms that we all learn as computer science.
Right, and it's not to say that you wouldn't be able to learn this on your own. It's just that you might not find the most optimal solutions, and maybe that there's enough people in your pool, your piscine, that you can self-correct, like,
yeah,
fish swimming in water or something. Mm-hmm. But
that might be the theory behind this.
I think that's what they're hoping for.
Are they selective on who gets to be a part of this?
There's a logic test they've taken up front in order to be invited and to begin with, which it's its own hurdle. I mean, when you look at the diversity statistics on the website, it's like 81% male still. So there's definitely things that they could tweak.
That's good that they put the statistics up. I mean, it's at least the start of it. Do you think that a logic test is an appropriate way to find out if someone would be a good developer, programmer?
Well, I think it touches on, like, the essence of what some people believe separates good programmers from people who could just code. And I feel like early on in my career, or when I was back in school, I bought into that a little bit more. But the more I'm out in the world dealing with people who have learned to code from all different walks of life and different areas and different pedagogies, I believe it less and less every day.
Yeah. I used to think that being a geek and being a software engineer was synonymous. And now that I'm around so many engineers, I realize that that's not the case at all. There are people that are like, this is my job and I do this, and they're really good software engineers, but in no way are they this, like, search and quest for knowledge and, like, weird thing that we do as geeks.
Right. I mean, like, once you get down to the code, you look at what somebody does and it's like, I would not have taken it that way at all, but it works and it has its own elegance. And it's different than how I would approach it, having had, like, all this sort of, like you mentioned, they had, like, this coding, computer science, some rigor and some algorithms here and, like,
computer science being applied mathematics rather than coding.
Yeah. And so then I would, like, approach it more maybe this way. But then I look at, like, well, that works really nice, too. And okay.
So do you think that maybe this is a miss on their part, trying to find people that have a logic bent?
I mean, I feel like there are many pitfalls that sort of jump out at me, especially as like a minority in tech, just reading through.
Like the 80% men?
Yeah, the press around it, like artificial hurdles that they might be throwing up that, like, this would be really beneficial to somebody who is just trying to break in, because it's free, the lodging is free. The food's not free, but the training and you have a place to stay, which is helpful.
But they're doing it in Silicon Valley. I mean, you're already not hitting, like, it's a pretty white male area for in tech already. It seems like there's other places of the country you could at least hit different minority groups.
But it really matters where you are on the internet.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is this curriculum is like the curriculum's obviously on the net. So, and there's no actual physical teachers. So why put it in like a really expensive place to live? I don't know. It seems weird.
They wanted to mimic what your like end goal would be, which would be like
to be here.
Driving up to some other office park job in the valley, maybe.
As there was just a story in the news about a guy who was working for the city of Palo Alto who can't afford to live there anymore and is moving to Santa Cruz.
Yeah, but
you know, I heard that story from a guy that used to cover land use.
Yeah, Gary Patterson.
Did you read it from his post too?
Yeah.
God. Anyway, that's all, of course, all about his take on that is watch out, Santa Cruz is about to explode in price, but it already has. Of course, you own a house, so you don't care. You're happy about that.
Well, I mean, it's not to anyone's benefit when the housing rises to the point where the people who grew up there can't afford to ever even hope to buy a house unless their parents are fabulously wealthy,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they die and leave their house to them. Like,
how do we get on this point? I lost our train of thought. Didi?
Well, we were talking about
someone who had to move
inequality,
to Santa Cruz.
Inequality and biases in testing methodology, and then we started talking about
housing market.
Income inequality is basically what we're talking about.
That's the thing is, it seems like this is a great program. I just don't know why it's here exactly. It seems like there'd be better places in the country to have a program like this. But in any case, are there volunteers in this pool, in this group? What's the French word again that's being used?
Piscine.
Piscine. Are there volunteers in the piscine that have already graduated, that like know their stuff, that are working?
I think it's pretty new in the U.S.
Okay.
But they have some people brought over from the more success, like the successful French version of it, I guess.
Okay, interesting.
But that doesn't seem like they have a whole lot of operating overhead.
So we have one more story that I kind of wanted to cover, if you don't mind. Can you tell us about this new discovery about HIV?
Oh yeah, sure. The too long didn't read is that. Scientists have discovered that they think they found the mechanism in which HIV is able to avoid detection in the body. So, like normally when there's something invasive going into your cells, they would recognize and like fight back.
Right.
But with HIV, they believe that it pulls off this its retroviral. Retroviral act of like stripping, acting as RNA and stripping off DNA
to do what it does
and replicate.
In this process, it becomes something that can't be detected,
right.
And therefore fought normally by the system.
But the reason why they're thinking this happens is because the pores, they feel like the sort of like modeling and looking at their pores, which open and close, sort of like your iris,
okay,
in your eye. Which allow the virus to take in nucleotides, which keeping in its true nature hidden from the cells itself. So they started sort of messing around with ways to sort of thwart this, and it seems like they might be getting closer to something that like helps the body recognize HIV virus.
Wow, so totally different way of
trying desperately to remember what I learned in the class, but I actually took a class back in the day on the biology of AIDS.
What was the teacher's name?
I have no idea.
See, you didn't even need a teacher.
But one of the issues with HIV is that when it infects a T cell, it doesn't actually come out of the T cell just out in the general bloodstream. Some do, but that's why the body can't react to it, is because it takes over the body of the T cell, and then that T cell attaches to another, and then the viral payload is passed between them without being exposed to the general bloodstream.
Oh, interesting.
And so this seems like they're able to take away any mystery that this T cell has in fact been infected, and as it's trying to send open that pore to
the T cell will be destroyed directly instead.
GP something or some number to make the connection. That's what I believe.
Geek Speak.
We are not biologists.
We should probably have Don back and talk all about this. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission, and Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like, even make money on it. Just let them know we said hello. Thanks to our patrons, of course. And if you want to be a patron or learn more about it, please go to geekspeak.org/support. Also, thank you to our intern, Chandler, who is diligently in the background making sure our website has all the good stuff. And also thanks to Greg Merkley, our support geek, working remotely from Canada, who titles this episode Hidden Figures Raid Code 42 and HIV Vulnerability. Didn't seem to read well. Can you do that, Miles? Can you read that one for me? Hidden Figures Raid Code 42. Oh, Hidden Figures Raid Code 42 for HIV Vulnerability. All right, cool. Also, the theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Thanks so much, and thank you for being here for episode 34 of our season 16. Miles, Dee Dee, that was awesome. Thanks for doing Geek Speak today.
Always a pleasure.
Till next time.
I'm Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio... It's a squeaky chair.
Be a natural.
Do you want a different chair? Get a different chair. That horse sounded like somebody died. It's like a cat. You can go this way.
Geek speak. Geek speak. Geek speak.